You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 161, by Rudolf Steiner, translated by Rory Bradley, entitled Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life and the World, 13 lectures. This is Lecture 8, given in Dornach on March 27, 1915. Having spent the last few times that we were able to gather together here on considerations connected with particular experiences, I would like to return today to something more oriented toward general spiritual science. At times, during these Easter considerations, it will perhaps be possible as well to discuss various things and even some specific things, as we will be continuing the considerations begun today through the next few weeks. I would like to start today with something that you have all known for quite some time now. That is, all spiritual scientific knowledge is gained not only with the help of the tools of the physical body, but also through the liberation of the soul spiritual element from those physical tools, so it can connect directly with the spiritual world. This direct connection with the spiritual world is thereby interrupted in daily life by the fact that when we are awake, we must always be at the service of the tools of our physical bodies if we hope to have a relationship to the world. And when we are sleeping, all of our will is concentrated on our connection with the physical body in such a way that the desire for the body spreads out like a cloud in the soul-spirit element during sleep and prevents us in the ordinary period of sleeping from experiencing anything in the spiritual world that we then occupy. And when we are sleeping, all of our will is concentrated on our connection with the physical body in such a way that the desire for the body spreads out like a cloud in the soul-spirit element during sleep and prevents us in the ordinary period of sleeping from experiencing anything in the spiritual world that we then occupy. Now, today we are interested in the person who truly understands the value of spiritual scientific activity as such, and the relationship of this spiritual scientific activity to the personal striving that brings the human being into the spiritual world through meditation and the concentration of thought, feeling, and will impulses. Above all else, we must be clear about this, and it is a deeply significant truth. The unified whole that surrounds us in our day-to-day world is not present in the spiritual world in the same way. I have already pointed out that this unity is grounded completely in the structure of the soul-spiritual human being. Most people, however, are constantly asking over and over, quote, "What is the unity of the world?" close quote. How satisfied they all would be if they could just trace it back to a single principle. Indeed, the external physical world presents itself to us as a unified whole, and those who are completely ruled by this devil of unity arrive at all sorts of thought abstractions as they try to find this unifying world principle. Such individuals often share similar characteristics, like an older man who approached me one evening when I saw him again. He shared with me, with the most intense sense of joy at discovering something, that he had finally found a unifying principle that could explain all of the phenomena of the world. And he said, in that state of intense joy, that this unifying principle could be expressed in no more than 10 or 12 words. He was so happy about this that he said he could now explain all of the cosmos. He claimed to be able to explain heaven, hell, and earth with just this one unifying principle. Recently, I thought of this experience again when someone wrote me a letter telling me that he urgently needed to have a conversation with me because he had met a person who was able to convert anyone in a matter of 5 minutes to a worldview that set the soul completely at ease. I hardly need say that there is no time for such exchanges within a spiritual stream that takes itself seriously. But those people who are possessed by a devil of unity, which is also simultaneously a kind of devil of comfort, are particularly numerous nowadays. Above all, we must take the things that are printed in title How to Know Higher Worlds very seriously, that as soon as we cross over the threshold of the spiritual world, we are really drawn into a threefold experience. I put particular emphasis on the fact that it is as though the soul is divided in three, and as soon as the soul crosses the threshold into the spiritual world, it is no longer possible to believe in this comfortable devil of unity. Indeed, as soon as we cross the threshold into the spiritual world, we feel that our being actually steps into three separate worlds, that it really actually steps into three distinct worlds. And we must never lose sight of this, that after crossing the threshold into the spiritual world, the experience of three distinct worlds is quite clear. Even the form of the physical body actually belongs to three worlds. I would say that this form of the human being, in quotes, that we encounter in the physical world is really the collaboration of three worlds that have a relationship of strong dependence, of necessity to one another. And if we consider the form of the head, then we must be clear, even when just speaking about the head and considering everything that belongs to the form of the head, we must be clear that the formative force, as well as the beings that work on and within the head, belong to an entirely different world than the formative forces and beings of our torso, and different than everything that belongs to our heart and arms and hands. It is as though the formative forces that constitute these material parts of the human being came from an entirely different world than the ones that constitute the head. And then again, the organs of the lower body and the legs belong to a different world than both torso and head. Now you might ask why all of this is significant. It is very significant because the present cycle of the human being is essentially such that a pure, genuine, and true experience of spiritual science can be had only when our soul spiritual rises up out of the head. This is, so to speak, the clairvoyant aspect of the human being that can bring forth spiritual scientific considerations that can properly serve humanity in our time. When it comes to this clairvoyant aspect, the soul spiritual aspect has largely risen out of the physical body and connected as though through an electrical current with the forces of the cosmos. This means that everything, the I capital, the astral body, and the etheric body, must rise out. This process of arising is, of course, in connection with the development of the so-called lotus flower. The forces that the lotus flower set in motion lie in the rising or blooming soul spiritual aspects of the human being. What is gained through the fact that clairvoyance has become a clairvoyance of the head can have spiritual scientific results in our time. For this head clairvoyant experience serves humanity. The clairvoyant experience that came about when the soul spiritual arose from the organs of heart, arms, and hands was fundamentally different. That form differed in an inwardly significant way from what comes about through what I am calling head clairvoyance. Lifting the soul's spiritual element from the physical heart organ happened through a kind of meditation more related to the will life. It happened through a humble surrender to the world process. Whereas head clairvoyance comes about through thoughts, through thought imaginations, but also through emotional imaginations. In general, in relation to these two forms of clairvoyance, it is such that the heart clairvoyance, or the breast clairvoyance, has by now already developed to the extent that it was meant to evolve with head clairvoyance. Heart clairvoyance leads more to will evolution, to a connection with the actions of the spiritual beings of the lower hierarchies, like those that are incarnated in the various kingdoms of nature. Whereas, head clairvoyance leads more to vision, knowledge, and perception in the higher worlds, which are more important to the human being now. These higher worlds are more important in the sense that the knowledge of these higher worlds is necessary to satisfy the need for certain insights that must gradually move more and more into present humanity. The closer we move toward our future earthly evolution, the less people will be able to live without their souls becoming brittle and arid, unless they can take the experience of this clairvoyance into their knowledge and insights. The third kind of clairvoyance comes about when what might be called the soul spiritual element is tempted out of the last third of the human body. In that case, toward this end, I will have to point toward an outward movement down below. Even if the phrase is not especially aesthetic, I have to refer to this kind of clairvoyance as stomach clairvoyance. So we can differentiate between head clairvoyance, heart clairvoyance, and stomach clairvoyance. Whereas head clairvoyance leads us to gather experiences about things that are in the fullest sense entirely independent of the human being, stomach clairvoyance leads primarily to experiences that are connected with processes that happen within the human being. The processes that occur within the human being must, of course, also be the subject of research. But there is already research being done about it in the fields of anatomy and physiology, which deal with all of those things. No one should come to the mistaken conclusion that there is no value in stomach clairvoyance in the highest sense of the word. It, of course, has its value. But we must be clear about the fact that stomach clairvoyance cannot teach people much about impersonal cosmic processes, since it primarily teaches us about the things happen inside the confines of a person's skin. Let me read that again. Since it primarily teaches us about the things that happen inside the confines of a person's skin. I will go on to speak about other differences between head and stomach clairvoyance in regard to the moral ethical realm. These two types can be easily differentiated. The heart clairvoyance stands between head and stomach clairvoyance. In regard to ethics, head clairvoyance is, comparatively speaking, the most important. People who strive in an impersonal manner to arrive at a view of the higher worlds in the manner described in title How to Know Higher Worlds, people who do not let themselves get discouraged about walking along that uncomfortable but certain path will develop in their clairvoyance an additional impersonal element. This will be an interest above all others in an objective knowledge of the world, of the cosmic and historical processes at work in the world's becoming. This head clairvoyance itself will speak of the human being in such a way as to draw attention to how humanity is established in the cosmic and historical process of life's becoming, to draw attention to the human being without the whole of the world process. The things that emerge from this head clairvoyance will always have an impersonal character. I would say even a universal and scientific character. It will contain communications that are of import for all people. I would ask you to take careful note of this, not just for one person or another. Stomach clairvoyance is filled largely with all manner of human egotism, and is thus very easily led down a path whereby the clairvoyant in question occupies himself largely with the occult foundations of his own abilities, with the occult foundations of his own personal value and character. This can be said to be a very natural tendency of what we might call stomach clairvoyance. Now, in regard to the visual nature of these two forms of clairvoyance, there is also a big difference. If you strive, as described in title How to Know Higher Worlds, to free your soul spiritual element from the perceptual apparatus of your head, which is to say that if you tempt the soul spiritual part of your head out of the physical mechanism, and are able to establish these soul spiritual portions of your head in the spiritual world, you will find it extremely difficult to get beyond shadow-like clairvoyant experiences. Stepping out of the head is connected, at first, with experiences that lack the colors and saturation of living memories, and therefore come forward quite colorless. Only when you push further and further through the obstacles that lie on this path do these experiences begin to lose their shadow-like quality and to become tinged somewhat with experiences possessing color and tone. The process that plays out here is one in which we first retreat from our heads and then find ourselves in a world that we find very hard to notice. Eventually, when we gain the ability to live outside of our head, these inner life forces grow stronger, and the result is that the forces that are streaming in from all the surroundings of the world start to pull together. Just think about that. These forces have to be pulled together from all around, and only then do we start to receive experiences lightly tinged with color and tone. In order to imagine this, let us say that you have a brightly colored bottle. Imagine that as you spread this bottle out over a large surface, the color becomes much paler, and the more you spread it out, the paler the color gets. Then, as you bring it together again, if this were just a pale yellow, you would end up with a very strong, very saturated yellow, because the same number of colored points would now be much more concentrated. Now, head clairvoyance looks at the whole cosmos, and what the human being is, according to a clairvoyant understanding of its nature, is spread out across the whole cosmos, and must be brought together by our life forces. Thus, the clairvoyant is really ready to get only a slightly tinted version of the shadow-like experiences through a laborious course of inner development. And then, once you have put in the great effort to have the general experience that really gives you the feeling of being outside your body, and once you have had this experience for a long, long time, and always received a stronger, more intensive feeling of inner experience, but one that is still not colored or toned. Then, gradually, the regions of the cosmos begin to approach this head clairvoyance. This is a matter of slow, selfless development. In particular, it must be said that the study of spiritual science is indispensable to this development. We must stress the fact that when spiritual science is presented, it can be understood. This cannot be said too often, that you do not need to be a clairvoyant to understand spiritual science. You must, of course, be clairvoyant in order to experience the phenomena for yourself. But once they have been described, you do not need to be clairvoyant. This understanding of spiritual science must precede the actual act of seeing. We might say here that this is the reverse of what is true for the physical sensory world. In the physical sensory world, we first have a proper act of seeing, and then we transition into thought considerations. We form the scientific assessments after the perception. When you move into the spiritual world, the opposite is true. There we must first develop the concepts and imaginations and strive to live objectively into spiritual science. Otherwise, we can never be certain that various observations we make of the spiritual world have been interpreted properly. The science must precede the act of seeing. And this is incredibly unpleasant for many people. The fact that they should really study spiritual science. Many people consider this an incomprehensible imposition. After all, they are working to have actual perceptions of the spiritual world. It is relatively easy to have such perceptions, to be sure. But in order to interpret them correctly, you need to embark both objectively and selflessly on the quest toward the spiritual. You must truly be filled by the spiritual world. Now, quite the opposite is true in the case of what might be called stomach clairvoyance. There we are starting with the aspect of the soul's spirit that works primarily with the physical body. For everything that exists in the world has a spiritual foundation. For example, when you eat a bit of kohlrabi, we are all mostly vegetarian, after all, and it gets worked on within your organism, you are not dealing solely with a physical chemical process carried out by the stomach and its forces and juices. The etheric body, astral body, and the eye are all active behind these processes as well. It would be entirely wrong to believe that they are material processes that do not have an underlying spiritual process. Just imagine for a moment that after a more or less opulent midday meal, you lie down and become clairvoyant, but clairvoyant in such a way that the soul spirit element of the digestive organs rises up, primarily out of these digestive organs themselves. Then you are living in the soul's spiritual element itself, while your stomach and the rest of your organs go on digesting. And although you are ordinarily unconscious of the spiritual process that is carried out in your etheric body, astral body, and eye, when you become clairvoyant, you become conscious of them. And then as you experience yourself in the soul spiritual element, you are able to see all of that work and formation and creation done by the soul spirit in the various limbs of your body during digestion. You see it as though it were projected outward into the world, and you appear to yourself as though reflected in the external etheric realm. Because you do not have to draw in the colors from the rest of the cosmos here, but instead are dealing with a process that is already concentrated within the confines of your own skin, you see the most beautiful clairvoyant images. To see a wonderful thing playing out around you in the most magnificent, brightest colors and formative processes, you need nothing more than to consider the digestive processes, or any other process that takes place within the body, in the spiritual human organs. This form of clairvoyance differs strongly from the other, in that while the other clairvoyance begins with shadow-like forms and gains a tinge of color and tone only with great effort, this form begins with the most beautiful and magnificent things you can ever see. You can express it as a law. If clairvoyance begins with the most magnificent forms, particular forms with magnificent color, then it is a clairvoyance that relates to processes that are carried out within the individual. I would like to express again that this form can still be of great value for research into the spiritual world. Just as anatomy and physiology must investigate the digestive processes and other bodily processes, so too it is of great scientific value to conduct such research into the spiritual element that lies behind these human processes. But it would be bad if we were to give in to any sort of confusions or delusions about this, if things were not to be interpreted properly. If you were to believe that such a clairvoyance that lacked the necessary preparation were able to offer more than insight into the processes carried out within the individual and projected out into the objective world, if you were to believe that it were possible to approach the regulating world powers, the predominating spiritual forces of the world, then you would be wrong. Just as you cannot solve the riddles of the world by investigating the human digestive process, you cannot approach the riddles and mysteries of the world through the development of stomach clairvoyance. So you can see how important it is to orient yourself in the world that you step into through the liberation of your soul's spiritual forces. No one should feel any sort of repulsion towards stomach clairvoyance because of the way it has been discussed. But we should all be clear about how this sort of clairvoyance is related to what spiritual clairvoyance can really develop into. And we must also keep ourselves from valuing too highly anything that can be achieved through a kind of clairvoyance that has a solely personal content. Only when we are able to look away from the solely personal aspect of these things, which can also be seen to have a personal content, and to consider them as the anatomist or physiologist does, in what he learns through autopsies and other investigations, only when we move into a scientific mode of considering these things do they obtain any value. By no means should any sort of religious feeling be attached to these things. That can only be connected with the experiences of head clairvoyance. The more we are able to treat the experiences of stomach clairvoyance in the objective scientific way that the results of anatomy and physiology are treated, the more correct we become in relation to it. I will now make the radical statement that not everything found on the path of clairvoyance is worthy of devotion, but everything found there is worth learning. This is how we must look at it. I have said that for our lecture cycle, it is particularly important that we incorporate the results of head clairvoyance into the general spiritual culture of humanity. This is truly important. In relation to this important matter, I would like to mention one side of it today. We live truly in a time during which humanity must be prepared to gradually move beyond mere philosophical idealism and into a true consciousness of the spiritual world, of the universal spiritual world in which we live, just as we live within the physical world. Now, let us start with an experience of head clairvoyance that we will easily understand if we have immersed ourselves a little in the things that were said in the Munich lecture cycle that was recently held, and that are also printed in my book titled The Threshold of the Spiritual World. I made particular mention there of the fact that our thinking undergoes a change the moment we liberate ourselves, particularly regarding our thinking, from the physical mechanism of the body. I said it a little bit grotesquely there when I said that when we become free in this way, our thinking no longer has the character that it has during normal everyday life. In normal everyday life, we must have the feeling, if we are not crazy, that we are the master of our thought world. And when we have two thoughts, we are the one who connects them or separates them. If we remember something, then we are already conscious of moving in our inner life from a present experience to a past one. We always have the feeling that we are the one who stands behind the weaving together of our thoughts. This feeling ceases the moment we allow our soul spirit in the head to free itself from the physical mechanism. The moment that we develop a kind of thinking that is free from the body. Back then I said it quite radically. I said that it is a bit like sticking your head into an anthill and feeling everything start to move frantically around you. Thoughts begin to develop a life of their own and to interact with one another. And during normal life, when we have two thoughts and connect them, like the two thoughts rose and red, we know that we are the master in our thought world, the one who connects thoughts to form concepts like, quote, the rose is red, close quote, or imaginations like the red rose. Things are not the same when we are outside the body. There the thoughts come alive and have their own life. Every thought becomes a being. One thought chases another. Another thought flees from a different thought. So the thought world gains a life of its own. Why does this happen? Well, what we experience in the normal thinking process of everyday life is merely images, merely shadows of thoughts. You can read about this in my book titled Theosophy. As soon as we develop thinking free from the body, every thought becomes like a shell, and an elemental being slips into that shell. The thought is no longer under our power. We release it like a satellite into the world, and an elemental being slips into it. Our thoughts become sort of occupied by elemental beings. And then this world teems and bubbles and weaves and bobs within us. So we can say that when we plunge the soul's spiritual portion of our head into the spiritual world, and the only way that it can be out there is if we are not in our physical body, then, when we plunge it into the spiritual world, we no longer experience thoughts in the way that we experience them in the physical world. Instead, we experience the lives of many beings. As I said back then, it is a bit like sticking your head into an anthill. We experience the lives of many beings, right up to those of the upper hierarchies. If we want to experience an angel, an archangel, or the spirit of an individual, then we must stretch out our thoughts in the manner just described. The being must be encased in our thoughts. We send our thoughts out, and the being slips into them and moves within them. When we perceive a being on Venus or Saturn, it happens because we have allowed our thoughts to extend, and the being from Saturn or Venus has slipped into them. We must get used to living with our head in the world of these upper hierarchies. Our own thinking stops, and our head becomes the locus for the work of the upper hierarchies. Now, it is the case that thinking was brought to its most pure level of clarity at the beginning of the 19th century through the philosophy of Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel. The heights to which thinking can soar were truly reached in this philosophy. The task that thinking was to complete was finished there. The next step, then, is for thinking to extend beyond itself, and for us to truly move into the teeming, weaving life of thought. In other words, we can say that we are living in a time where humanity is called to perceive the upper hierarchies. We are to be accepted into the world of the upper hierarchies and strip ourselves of the fear of losing our thinking to the life and interaction present in that world. The 19th century was possessed by this fear and terror of life in the upper hierarchies. This essentially led people to pray, although they did not even realize it, quote, O my dear Ahriman. They were not familiar with Ahriman, of course, so the words of the prayer were different. Quote again, my dear Ahriman, save my thoughts from being claimed by the life and interaction of the upper hierarchies, for otherwise I might one day have some sort of being from Uranus or Jupiter or Saturn or the sun in my thoughts, rather than something earthly, and those beings might run amok with it. Close quote. You might be thinking that nobody in the 19th century was thinking this, but I will prove to you that they were. Ludwig Feuerbach was a 19th century philosopher who fought especially against the idea of immortality, against any belief in a supra-sensory world, because he considered these to be the beliefs of fantastical and mystical dreamers, and to be detrimental to all of humanity. This Ludwig Feuerbach, in his book titled Thoughts on Death and Immortality, wrote the following sentences. I would ask you to inscribe them well in your souls. Quote, the active person who busies himself with the objects of everyday life has no time to think of death, and therefore no need of immortality. If he does think of death, he takes it only as an admonition to spend wisely the time that is given to him, and not to waste precious time on useless things, but rather to spend it completing the life tasks he has set for himself. If the human finds his perfection only after his time on earth, up in heaven, on Uranus or Saturn or somewhere else, then there is no philosophy and no science at all. Universal and deducted truths would not be the objects of our minds, nor would thoughts, knowledge, and concepts, these purely intellectual essences and objects, be residents of our heads. Instead, those residents would be our heavenly brothers, the beings of Saturn and Uranus. Instead of math, logic, and metaphysics, we would have the most exact portraits of these heavenly residents. That heavenly being would reside between us and the objects of knowledge and thought. They would obscure our view of those objects and cause a complete and eternal darkening of the sun in our minds. Close quote. For Feuerbach, the sun, in quotes, is his own thinking. So he has the whole picture of what has to happen. But he has such an unholy fear of it that he prays to dear Ahriman to protect him from what the human being might actually be responsible for accomplishing here. He thinks that there would be no math or logic in our heads, but only beings from Saturn and Uranus. Quote again, they would be nearer and more closely related to us than thoughts, ideas, or concepts, for they are not merely purely spiritual or abstract beings like these, but rather are sensory spiritual beings, beings that only express the powers of the imagination. Our entire mind would become merely a dream, a vision of the beautiful future. He who is hindered by the demands of reason from swimming about in this boundless ocean of imagination will recognize that in the depths of our mind the life light of the angels and all of the other similar heavenly beings is extinguished, as though by air that they cannot breathe. Close quote. Steiner again. So if these beings were to enter into our thoughts, then our minds would become a dream, writes Feuerbach. He feels secure only in the realm of thought. And if the beings of angels and other heavenly beings were to enter into these thoughts, he would feel insecure. This is the prayer to Ahriman, that he might shield humanity from any knowledge of the spiritual world. Written in the 1840s by Ludwig Feuerbach, that opponent of any spiritual worldview. What does that mean? This means nothing less than that the time is ripe for arising to the spiritual world. For if you simply take seriously what this man described, then you will have found the path into the spiritual world. You need only to fight against the connection with Ahriman. So you see, it is not the fault of heaven, if I may put it this way, that spiritual science is not penetrating into our culture, for it works its way into the minds of its opponents. It wants to come into the world. So it is not heaven's fault. The gods are giving humanity wisdom. Spiritual science is entering. Just as people have been arming themselves under Ahriman's directive, it is now up to us to no longer arm ourselves, but rather to have the courage to take spiritual science truly and completely seriously. This is what we have to say about these developments in the 19th century. We have to say that in the spiritual world it was predestined that after the era of idealism, the era of spirit would come. And it is up to humanity to open its senses and its heart-mind to take up this spiritual world. The kind of materialistic worldview that found its most philosophically gifted proponent in Ludwig Feuerbach is like an onslaught, an attack against what is meant to come into humanity. The spiritual forces come down from above. From below, the forces of understanding and recognition must also arise. We might say that Ludwig Feuerbach managed to find a very characteristic way of expressing himself. The darkening of the sun in the soul must begin when thoughts begin no longer to be thought, but when the beings of Uranus, Saturn, and Venus begin to play within them, the beings of the upper hierarchies. A darkening of the sun in the mind would come then. People have an unholy fear of this, but this darkening of the sun in the soul is not created by heavenly beings. Indeed, those beings want to bring their light to humanity. The darkness was created by people through their connection with Ahriman and by the cloud of fear that they have spread throughout their auras. They sought to launch attacks against the entrance of the spiritual world. But this much is clear, that the darkening started with people. And we also have to say that this darkness continues to grip people more and more, this obfuscation of free cognition that would approach a clairvoyance of mind. This is something that people created themselves, and we can see that during the 19th century, people had a certain love and sympathy for all sorts of brief, inconsequential thoughts. In short, for everything that in the end really did not need to be thought at all. There was a preference for anything that you would not have to be accountable for later. People loved unbiased and objective knowledge and thinking less and less. And so it should be no wonder that eventually this love of nebulous, unclear, and incomplete thought took on a morally repugnant character in public life. But as this character was fostered, all sympathy for the thinking life went stale, which then spread out into everyone's general behavior. This atmosphere generated a very strong counterforce against spiritual science, which resounds with clarity in every aspect. Spiritual science must have a love and sympathy for consequential, finished, and not half-finished thoughts. It must not be content with things that are unclear and dark. It must, rather, follow everything that brings light to the world, not those things that shine a false light on a small area. And in this regard, we still have a great number of things to combat. You can have really strange experiences sometimes when your karma brings you to them. And it does do that, indeed. You see, several years ago, you could read an article in a newspaper called Hochland, Highland, that was directed against spiritual science and presented all manner of foolish nonsense against it. It was widely read, and the author was considered a particularly excellent philosopher, particularly because the newspaper Hochland did everything that it could to tell the world that they had found a capable philosopher in Dr. Lutosławski, who wrote the article and could take the field against spiritual science. Now, recently the following has occurred. This Dr. Lutosławski wrote a letter to Karl Muth, the editor of Hochland. The letter displeased the editor so much that he said that in his country only the residents of madhouses would write the kind of garbage that was found in that letter. Then the editor published the things that the philosopher wrote in the Süddeutschen Monatsheften. The content of what he wrote is not important to us today. I simply want to draw your attention to the fact that the same man who published this then had to add, quote, in publishing this letter from Lutosławski, it might also be advantageous to learn something about his personal relationships, close quote. Then he, Muth, offers several strange biographical details about Lutosławski, and then publishes a letter from him, in which he says that such gaps are the sort that you expect to be filled in only by an inner hatred. And so, the fact of the matter is that the man whom the editor of Hochland is now tearing down is the same man who was brought forward as a battering ram against the spiritual scientific worldview. I believe that if someone can be called a fool, then you have the right to consider him to be a person who might talk like a fool in other circumstances. And it would be more consistent for the editor of the newspaper if he would only say that back then he let such a foolish man pass judgment on Dr. Steiner's theosophy. He is guarding himself against this. People have no real interest in true consistency in the moments when it really is most important. But through such things, we get a feeling for the origins of the forces that are working against theosophy and spiritual science in the truly scientific sense that we practice. I mentioned this particular instance because karma has directed me toward it in the last few days. Karma is indeed a peculiar thing. I am passing a bookstore. Someone walking with me, who probably has no idea that there is anything notable about it, points toward a book in the window. I go into the bookstore, buy the book, and there within it I find this stuff. Karma leads us well, even in everyday life. Based on what I could see on the cover of the book, there was no indication that this article which casts the author in such a strange light would be in there. You could bring up many similar things and set them before your soul. But you should also understand that in connection with the things that I have just said, the responsibility that is placed upon every one of us by such things grows ever greater the more we think about them. There is no requirement from any sort of authority for anyone to have one thought or another, or to form one judgment or another. It goes without saying that everyone could think about this article differently, and that there is no particular direction for how to think about it. What matters is that our sense of responsibility should grow ever greater, and that we see that we must do everything we can to find the ways in which spiritual science can be introduced into contemporary world culture. and some of the things that have happened recently in connection with world events on the large scale make it absolutely urgent that certain things which have remained dormant be brought into the open soon. These are the thoughts that I wanted to introduce into your considerations in order to show how Ahriman's influence on thinking during the 19th century brought about an occasion for pushing aside the spiritual world, even though it continued to have an effect on the thoughts of those who denied it, because its time has come. Quote, "The time has come," close quote. These words from Goethe's titled Märchen are quite fitting here. All of this must be affirmed and supported in the near future. The end of Lecture 8.